How long were you out?
Well, 8 years, I think.
8 years.
Yeah, we served back together in the house. My first.
Yeah, you were 03. Your first term?
Yeah. I'll call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this sunny and warm June 15th. And we'll open an informational meeting on coordinated care organizations with progress. We have our first witness is going to report on two different CCOs, and therefore we'll give him up to an hour to report. And if you would call the first witness, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First scheduled presentation is from Pacific Source Community Solutions, Mr. Dan Stevens.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, Mr. Stevens. Could you just introduce yourself as you start?
Sounds good. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Dan Stevens. I work for Pacific Source Community Solutions, overseeing their product lines, of which Medicaid is one. Been very involved in the CCO, Coordinated Care Organization, components from the beginning. And we do, as was mentioned, we are a CCO for the Columbia Gorge region, Hood River and Wasco County. We're also the CCO for the Central Oregon region, which covers the counties of Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook. And if it's okay with the committee, what I thought I would do, since we're covering two, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
That's good. Is just go ahead and go through. You did a nice job of laying out some of the topics you wanted to cover, gave us a chance to sort of organize our thoughts. A lot of how we organize and administer the CCOs is similar in both regions, governance models, some of the constructs, the care model components. It would probably sound a little repetitive if I went through one for a half hour and then went through the other. So if it pleases the committee, I'll cover both as we go through the topics and differentiate where it's appropriate and allow you to ask questions that are nuanced to each local CCO, if that's your prerogative. So
I suppose given the time frame in that you're doing that, we usually let somebody go all the way through a presentation, but maybe we'll, you're okay with it, entertaining questions as we go along.
That's perfect. I like that. Yeah. Okay. And you have, I understand you have a handout.
We do.
That looks something like that. I've got some slides here. Great. So by way of background, and not to go into too much detail, again, we do operate two of Oregon's CCOs. The Columbia Gorge region, which is those two counties, has about 13,000 members, and the Central Oregon three-county region has about 55,000 members right now, so just under about 70,000 beneficiaries. And that's up, as is the trend across the state, about 75% from pre-2014 ACA expansion. So significant growth commensurately, the statewide growth. We'll talk a little bit about the governing structure and the overall structure of the CCO as we get into the next slide. We do have an approach that is a little bit unique in this state, where we built a health council model, so a local governance model that not only met the spirit of the statute that lifted up the CCOs, but was local in a sense of saying Pacific Source, as the CCO organizer administrator, has ceded the governance of the CCO to a local health council. So in both of those regions, we lifted up a 501c3 not-for-profit organization. In Central Oregon, very creative naming. Central Oregon is called the Central Oregon Health Council, and the Gorge, it's called the Columbia Gorge Health Council. Each of those councils act as the board, the governing bodies for those respective CCOs. They each have 12 members. Each member has one vote, so there are no majority votes or blocks. And Pacific Source Community Solutions has just one vote on each of those respective health councils. So we're one vote of 12. And in the narrative that was submitted, we actually covered the actual representation, typical representation, some of the major risk-taking entities of the healthcare organizations in the community, the hospital systems, the big multi-specialty clinics in both communities, the federally qualified health centers are on the governing body, practicing practitioners both at the primary care level and behavioral health, citizen representatives, both of whom are active in the CAC committees and chair, if not co-chair, those committees in both regions. And then actually in both CCO regions, the elected officials, county commissioners from each of the counties that are represented, all of them sit on those committees representing. That's been a really nice representation. Not only have they been active participants, they have an opportunity to represent the community mental health programs, the public health slate of activities that happen in those regions, as well as now the early learning hub activity that they're both, that they're all very active in at the county level. So that's been a nice addition to the board. And in both regions, actually, the board chair is a county commissioner in both the Gorge and the Central Oregon region. If you go to the slide that has a graphic depiction of the title of the slide is Pacific Source CCO Model, this is a representative of just exactly how this governance structure works. And so briefly, and when we presented this initially to OHA in the certification process for CCOs, it was met with a little bit of an eye roll. It was met with a little bit of a, well, if you're going to have a contract with a separate organization, even if it's a community organization, so it has nice representation, where's the single point of accountability, which was a big part of the CCO formation and the desire to be able to go to one entity and say, are you getting the job done or not, as it relates to transformation? Our answer to that was, we think this actually meets best of both. So we are still the single point of accountability as the contracting entity to the state. However, we have a relationship, we call it a joint management agreement, that is a binding relationship with the separate governing entity, with the local health councils. And the more we chatted through it, OHA warmed up to it and said, yeah, we actually think that model is worth testing. We think it's a model that has some elegance to it. It forces some process into everything we do.
Excuse me, which is a single source, Pacific Source?
Or? Yes, correct.
Right.
Yeah,
sorry.
As the CCO. So we would be what we call the operating entity, but we're the contracted CCO to the state. So if we're not meeting, for example, one of the transformation plan benchmarks, if we're not performing on the quality indicators, the state looks to us and says, tell us what's going on. So we do have this agreement, the joint management agreement with those local health councils. These are two separately run CCOs. So this slide is a depiction of the model, but the model is the same in both regions, but the agreements are separate. The local governing entities are local. And then obviously we have, through the CCO contract, our relationship with the state. And then under the health council sits the standing committees of the CCO, the required committees like the community advisory committees, the clinical advisory panels. In one region, we have an operating council that has as its membership many of the sort of director level, COO level operators of the various entities that come together. In both regions, we have a standing finance committee. So just to give you a couple examples of how we work with that governance interface, It is not Pacific Source's board of directors that necessarily approves how we allocate dollars in the global budget. It's the local health councils. The approval of the strategic plan, the annual work plan, what we're going to do to achieve quality incentive metrics goes to those local health councils. It certainly goes through our organization as, here's how we're running the CCO, here's how we're performing. But those decisions in that strategic direction really lifts from those local health councils. And that's worked quite well. Other functions we do, as you can imagine, if we're the accountable entity to the state, so we bear the ultimate risk. We're the risk-taking entity. We perform the numerous managed care functions, provider credentialing and contracting, the payment of claims, customer service, those kinds of things. If I could, it might be interesting just to share a couple of examples just to highlight how that governance model works as it relates to some of the things we have to do over the course of a year. So we integrated dental, and I think that, gosh, your memory starts to fade a little bit. That was July of last year that Pacific Source integrated the dental, set of services, the scope of services that were previously provided by the dental care organizations that they took risk for. That came into our CCO as it did other CCOs last year. We have conversations, obviously, with those subcontractors, those dental organizations, and say, what is it that you do? How are we going to dovetail? Who's going to do what as this comes into the CCO? We also go, just as any organization would, to those health councils as our board governance strategy direction group and say, what is it that we as a community hope to accomplish as it relates to integrating dental? And from that conversation, then, we don't go there to negotiate the contract. We don't invite those multiple parties into the room to negotiate with Advantage Dental or ODS. But that contract and the contents of it and what we're pushing for is very much informed by that local voice through the health council dialogue. So in the case of dental, an example of that was, gosh, if you look at dental, the CCOs had some guideposts. You know, dental in the statute had, there were some components in there that limited CCOs from an ability, some would argue, to make really dramatic change. And that, I think there were some good reasons for that. Our community struggled with that a little bit in terms of, well, what if we want to do widespread integration of dental care into primary care, even in the first year? How do you get there? So the Health Council voice, and we have in Central Oregon, not in the Gorge, Dr. Shercliffe from Advantage Dental sits on that board. So he's a board member of the Central Oregon Health Council. So what do we do? How do we make change, but preserving the DCO's ability, especially as it relates to what was in the statute, to do what they were going to continue to do in that space? We came up with two things that we said we may want to start messing in these areas. One was access. The DCOs were beholden to certain access standards under their contract with OHA. The community voice was, well, what if we want to achieve access standards that are actually superior to what's in your current environment? How do we do that? So what we informed then was a process in that contract. It just lays out a process and says, we will form in the committee a multi-stakeholder group that weighs in on dental access, how that relates to quality, cost, the patient experience. The dental organizations will have a chance to participate in that, if not lead it. After all, it's related to their field of work. If there are recommendations that come out of that task force about how to improve access, that then we want to have inform new standards, new levels of performance. Once the health council has endorsed that, so again, the community voice of real key stakeholders and consumer representatives, then we were able to put in those dental agreements. Once that's endorsed at a health council level, so at a community level, we then will be accountable to contracting with you in such a way as those standards are adhered to. And if you don't desire to contract in a way that escalates that, we have a chance to go somewhere else. We can build a dental network. We can go to another DCO that's willing to do that. And that was a way for the dental organizations to say, okay, you're not going to make that kind of change overnight. I'll be invited into a process. The community gets to weigh in alongside us. And then we go forward. So one example of how we leverage the governance model in a way that we think perhaps has a little more process sometimes. We think it can be a little more potent than just the CCO going up against that subcontractor and saying, you know, your world's going to change tomorrow and here's how it's going to change. Any questions on governance or structure before I move on? I think one of the questions that was related to risk and profitability and even profit levels. And so before I go there, any questions on just how we're structured?
How does your board of directors relate to the
Yeah, the question is how does our board of directors, so Pacific Sources corporate board of directors, there's certain things that the local governing council couldn't advise Pacific Source to do or tell it to do. Like we couldn't purchase another CCO only as informed by the local health councils. That would be a decision that would have to come from the corporate board, some of those big rock items. But as it relates to the month-to-month, quarter-to-quarter, year-to-year performance in the CCO, our board gets reports. Our board is well aware of the governing model that we've built in those communities, very supportive of it. They ask questions about the CCO. They're engaged. We've been performing by the standards of our contract at a pretty high level. They're pretty happy with how it's going. And I think they feel like the governance model is elegant and worth continuing.
Any other questions at this point?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Chairman.
Mueller? Be nice to him.
Yeah, be nice. So can the Central Oregon Health Council recommend replace you or whoever your predecessor is going to be? Is that a power?
The question is, could they do that?
Yeah.
So it's a good question. The joint management agreement is set up such that if we underperform, if we don't perform, and if say the Columbia Gorge Health Council said we're going to break that agreement, you're in breach of it, we're going to terminate it. I suppose what would happen is the state would come and tell us, well, you don't have a governing body or a governance model that meets statute. Mm-hmm. We'd have a couple options. We could morph our corporate board and say we do now meet statute. In our communities, that wouldn't really work, because I think a lot of this is built on, do you have the support of the community and the major stakeholders? So as you play out that scenario, it's not a direct, it's not necessarily direct. It would be a little bit more indirect.
Right.
So if you turn the page to, I guess on mine it's page 4, but I printed these 2 per page. So there's a slide that that at the title is Risk and Profitability, and we pulled just a few of the high points out of the narrative that was submitted. You know, as other CCOs, we are ultimately that risk-bearing entity. I'll talk later about how we've contracted in our regions in such a way as that risk is shared, many of the similar mechanisms to what other CCOs are doing. Correct, yeah. But the ultimate risk-bearing entity is Pacific Source. What we have done is in very much a part of the initial governing model and the formation, the conversation was around, what do we do with finances? What do we do with profit? And when we came to the table in forming that model, we said we're interested in a model that really develops community shared risk and shared reward at an entity level and even at a community level. So what do we mean by at a community level? What we structured ultimately out of that was that in taking the risk, and as these insurance cycles are prone to do, you can have good years and bad years, obviously. What we agreed in the community, both communities, is that if we had a year in which our profit margin was above 2%, anything above 2% would go to the health council. So it's not a 50-50, it's 100%. So if we make $10 million and our 2% was at a $5 million level, the additional 5 go to the health council. And we have that scenario from the 2014 performance year. So the estimate here, and these are estimates, is that in Central Oregon, just somewhere in the neighborhood of 6.5 to 7 million through that mechanism will go to the health council. In the Gorge, it's a little smaller. It's in the neighborhood of 500,000. And then we're in the process now. We've talked framework. We've built a framework that we've endorsed at those health council levels of, well, what do we do with those dollars? Should those dollars be reinvested in the care of patients with chronic illness, or should they be invested upstream on things that we think might have a longer ROI but longer term are going to impact the health of the community? And that's the leaning. The leaning is, let's really look at things that align with those community health assessments, the community health improvement plans, and invest in those areas that are the highest priority. Central Oregon, one of the ones that jumps off the page is housing. Housing is an expensive investment for few people, potentially. That's the argument that sometimes comes on the other side of that. But if housing as a means to getting stable employment, becoming stable from a health perspective, or becoming stable in the, say, the post-hospital discharge environment, hugely important piece. So we will sit down over the next couple months and in alignment with our community health improvement plan, which we also did together as a region like other regions, we will say, what are the highest priorities? And if we're going to invest, let's invest in a portfolio of things that are the highest priority at a community level. So again, we're one voice in that.
Have funds already going into reserve at that point?
Funds will have already gone into reserve. In fact, we're doing final reconciliations now. You know, claims take a while to come in and get reconciled. You close your books on the year. We have provider settlements that in that hierarchy come first, both on the behavioral health and the physical health side. Those are things that have been in place for a long time. Once those play through, then that reconciliation happens, and it literally is a check we write. So We don't hold it and reserve it. We write the check. And then the Health Council, as an entity, as a 501c3 entity, holds the dollars from there on out.
Can I push on that just a bit?
Yeah.
One of the issues of 2014 was you had a lot of new people who didn't get care. They're going to get care in 2015.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's that kind of reserve
I was
talking about.
It's a great question. We're having that conversation as well right now. In fact, the question sort of is as you addressed it, which is I'll go with numbers again that are illustrative. If we write a $5 million check, it goes over to the side of the equation that doesn't count, technical term, the medical loss ratio piece. That's what you're referring to. If some of those people start to come through and need care, have we reserve the money somewhere else such that it's not available. We may take some of that money and actually reserve it. So we would hold it as a reserve liability on our books. We couldn't spend it until directed by the Health Council, but we may well do that.
Representative Lively?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a couple of questions. One, I'm trying to understand in this profit surplus, whatever it is, and I'm trying to understand. So before you get to that point, so overhead. Mm-hmm. So what's your calculated overhead rate in relation that comes out before then?
It does come out before then, and it's actually something that's also negotiated in that joint management agreement. And so we make transparent those financials. We have a finance committee that we present and share those financials with every month, just like you would a board finance committee. We've negotiated just under a 6% that was somewhat lifted from the historical, which is pretty consistent with the state. You establish the medical rates and you add 6 plus 2, and the 2 being sort of the profit or the expected or anticipated. We use just under 6 for that. It may flux a little bit every year based on the functions that we're asked to play. We left it open in the joint management agreement that it wasn't that it would always be 6 or less. The negotiation, or I guess not even that, the discussion was, gee, if we ask Pacific Source to fulfill functions that are broader than what they are today, it may go above 6, but it's negotiated at a local level.
So if I might follow up. So one more question has to do, and kind of a follow-up from what Chairman Greenlick was talking about, the amount you keep in reserves for potential increases, but also, so if you provide that money to the council to start other initiatives of that, mm-hmm. So what's the holdback or the concern about being able to maintain those initiatives, or does the initiative kind of a one-year shot and it's over?
Right. That's another really good question. So we're addressing the problem in an imaginary way now, sure. Or in an anticipatory way. So anticipating those surpluses, if you will, the conversation that we're having, and that we could have included it if anybody's interested, we'd be happy to share it. The framework that we built that we now have agreement on at the Health Council in terms of guiding these investments, mm-hmm. It says a couple things. It says, and we're running into this with those transformation funded projects, legislatively funded projects, which have been wonderful, and is a whole nother story of the CCO, I think, that's yet to be written. Some of those, as you can imagine, they are 12 months into existence, or if they took a few months to lift up, they're 8 months into existence, and now the money is being expended, as was agreed to, and you're coming up way too soon to address this true question of effectiveness or efficacy based on some evidence versus, you know, so do you keep funding it? And if so, based on what? Do you have evidence? So what we're building into this framework is, if we're going to make an investment, let's look at it like a grant-making organization would do and say, almost require that X percent of the dollars be spent on evaluation. So up front, tell us what your rigorous evaluation plan is, who's going to help you with those research questions, what they are. Spend money on that so that we know that we can at least have a good chance of knowing what was the impact, and therefore then what could be the sustained funding model in the future. And then the other one is, these should be things that we would commit to at least on a 2-year, if not a 3-year basis. So not just 1 year. That's just too soon. You come back asking for, you know, funding into perpetuity before you have any idea.
Sure. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Please go on.
Other questions? Okay, good. There are some, there's a, the next slide is really general, and what we did was we highlighted in the narrative some of the areas. This is really in relation to the question about where, paraphrasing, but where are you driving change that is...
In the narrative, we're talking about this document that you also have.
Correct, yeah. Where are you driving change as a CCO that is starting to actually impact care at a ground level? I think another at least implication there was where are you making change that will have a lasting impact? And so I thought what we did here was we just highlighted the eight transformation areas. We referenced also the transformation plan documents that are submitted as part of our contract with OHA. Those are those very detailed plans that outline with actually some proposed measurable benchmarks, measurable milestones, where are you going to be in a year on these different components. And so these are the eight. What I thought I would do is just highlight in both regions some of the work that's going on that we think answers that question, and stop me or let me know and make this as much of a dialogue as you want it to be. The first one would be something that's really lifted from the development of patient-centered primary care homes, obviously a space that all regions are working in, both from a payment model perspective as well as a capabilities perspective, and no different in the Columbia Gorge and in Central Oregon. A couple things I guess I would just say. We've had the great fortune in those regions of having strong primary care provider partners who have wanted to stay engaged in Medicaid. That doesn't mean everybody, but the vast majority, especially the large organizations. So the Providence Hood River Memorial Hospitals of the world, the Mid-Columbia Medical Centers of the world and their employed physicians, St. Charles in Central Oregon and their medical group, and then two very strong federally qualified health centers, actually three, two in Central Oregon, one in the Gorge, who have been financially strong enough to grow, anticipating expansion, and not only grow, but through alternative payment models, invest in integrated behavioral health, in some cases integrated dental, and so on and so forth. Lifting from those, we've also in both regions had a real concerted effort and focus on this dynamic that everybody's trying to address. Where, how do you find and or anticipate who the 2-5% of the patients in any given year that are going to be responsible for expending 50% or more of the dollars, and really understand their complex needs and really wrap your arms around their situation, not just in a medical sense, but in a multidisciplinary sort of healthcare plus social determinants sense. And so in Central Oregon, and some the story's been told a few times, we've worked with clinics to set up an actual complex care center, sort of an ambulatory ICU approach, with clinics referring those patients that meet those criteria into that clinic that was really set up at from the get-go to manage only those patients, to really specialize in intensive patient management, integrating pharmacy, behavioral health, community health worker, transportation, and other modalities, just to really do a very good job with patients who are very vulnerable. In the Columbia Gorge, same patient population, different approach, decided to pursue more of a distributed approach. There's a group that gets together to organize around actually 200 patients. It's called the T200 group or strategy. And through analytics, sort of prospective analytics, same methodology as Central Oregon, getting together with clinicians, identifying patients who need that level of intervention, but not necessarily referring to a brick and mortar complex care center, a much more distributed approach to taking care of that population, using a lot of the same resources, but distributing them through the five or six biggest primary care clinics in the community. On the payment side, if I could just comment, it's not necessarily a direct care model intervention, but I think a lot of us know that how you pay for healthcare has a pretty big bearing on how healthcare is organized and delivered. A couple of really good examples. I'll actually start with an example of payments for substance abuse care. substance abuse providers would be quick to tell you that if you look at the healthcare pie of spending, dollars that are spent on substance abuse would be, they wouldn't even be a piece of the pie. They'd be a little knife edge. They're just tiny. But the impact on total spend is massive for patients who really have substance abuse issues. The exacerbation of those issues when, as it relates to severe and persistent mental illness, physical health, comorbidities. And so we took a look at that with those providers and came up with a pretty creative way to pay for their services, starting with residential care. So, you know, persistent and severe substance abuse patients who have needed or need residential treatment. And instead of just buying bed capacity for those episodes of care, so if somebody goes into residential treatment, the typical, what's your payment per day, which the chronic complaint was, well, that's actually not enough. I don't make enough money off of that to stay alive. I have to balance that with my commercial payers and such. And just sort of lifting the lid off that question, sitting down with them and saying, what would it take to hit these outcomes? Outcomes related to retention of people post-residential care, so retention in outpatient programs, which is a huge metric for substance abuse patients, certain quality metrics and even cost metrics. And they said, well, to their credit, they said, you don't necessarily need to pay us that much more. Just pay us differently. Pay us to take care of those patients so that we can then organize a system of care that will live within those dollars and maybe hit those outcomes. So we have a per person per month capitated patient our payment now for patients who meet that criteria. And it's not a PMPM for patients who all of a sudden pop up and have that diagnosis. It's a PMPM across the entire population. So it's not, again, it's not large, but it's for anybody who comes into their care. And what they have, and then there are quality components to it. There's a withhold component that bonuses those providers. This is not a world they have lived in before. They haven't lived in a show us the outcomes, pay for performance type of reimbursement structure. A lot of that care has to go out of area. I would say not a lot, but it does. So there's always a nervousness about that. How do I control that? And they have designed a system of care within that residential environment where they're connecting with the outpatient providers on the front end. So for somebody coming into residential care, the outpatient providers come in and are part of that care from the very beginning. Over the course of a 20-day stay, which can be an average, they are interfacing all along the way. These are different tax IDs, different providers. And then by the time the patient is discharged, and they're often discharged earlier, because of that interaction, and they go into outpatient care, they have a relationship and a knowledge of that provider, those providers. They're investing in things like peer specialists who are sort of guiding folks through, folks who've been through that process, who have recovered, so they're becoming mentors. They never felt like they had those dollars to invest. The outpatient providers never felt like they had those dollars to invest. Their margins were tiny. And now that they're taking a look at it and saying, how do we just take care of these patients as providers in this space? They're coming up with these things that they've never done. And what they're realizing is this classic thing we talk about a lot, but it's hard to accomplish, which is you can make small investments at the risk of your own dollars and your own outcomes. But if the potential yield on those investments is rewarded in your contract, then at least you're going to be motivated to try to start making those investments. So they did a nice presentation just up the road the other day at CCO Oregon. This is RimRock in Prineville. This is Best Care Treatment Services in Crook Jefferson and Deschutes. And they have some nice outcomes already about around retention and around quality indicators for residential patients that are they haven't had in 20 years. So
aren't you capitating lots of other components of your healthcare system.
We are, yeah, we are.
Do
with
you
caution, but we are.
Sub-capitating that
before? We're, yeah, so the.
We're ahead of everybody else, I think.
Well, I don't know about that, but we've had incredible willingness from providers in the community to step up and say, gosh, if we're really going to start behaving differently, we have to be willing to be paid differently. So we do, as I know a lot of regions do, we have a capitation payment for primary care. So you put a circle around the sort of the comprehensive codes that come out of primary care, and that's a capitated payment. It has quality metrics attached and such. It's part of a bigger framework around an overall total cost and quality of care contract for primary care. We have in Central Oregon, St. Charles has been willing to step up and say, we'll actually take a fixed monthly amount of money based on historical spend for inpatient and outpatient hospital services that are local. So that's a big chunk of the global budget right now that now has a completely different mechanism around it. And that's been a nice story. Once that happened, the local providers through the IPA, the Central Oregon IPA, came to the table in a whole different way in a contracting mechanism and said, if we do that capitated payment, let's share both in the risk on the quality and some of the process metrics to perform under that contract, so it wasn't just financial, but give us some of the upside if we actually perform on it. So now it quite literally is a three-way negotiation, if you will. There are things that we still have to be careful about from an antitrust perspective in that negotiating room, but those negotiations start, or at least the framing of how those contracts roll, start with really largely all the physical health providers represented in the room, and not just we go talk to them and we finish that contract and now we go talk to them and we've already got a limit on what we can do because we've already signed this contract. So
we have an antitrust shelter. What's the issue?
Fear. The unknown. Lawyers telling us to be careful.
That.
Right. So there's just a long history, I think, of observing that that's a fragile space.
So the sharing in the upside, is that before that profit? I'm trying to understand again. So it's capitated and you have the expense, but that whatever right. sharing is going to occur is before whatever is calculated as profit afterwards.
It's actually on two levels. And so when you look at your overall projected profit and loss, you know, that global budget, and you set those budgets, then you go and you look, okay, we need to now contract for the subcomponents. And so those subcomponents have some downside upside with them, you know, a withhold, and then, hey, if certain performance pieces are hit, that gets paid back. And then on this kind of umbrella level is the overall risk and reward at the kind of global budget level. Yeah.
Sure. Thank mm-hmm. you.
Keep going. All righty. Moving along. And then actually the other piece that was called out was tell us about integration. You know, this topic of integration, which is obviously really broad. So there's a slide here that is distinct to Central Oregon. And there's a slide that has some content for the Columbia Gorge. Let me talk through a few of these pieces. These are probably recurring themes. As you've heard from a handful of other CCOs, when we initially did our transformation plan submission in Central Oregon a couple years ago, we had, I think, three or four sites in the community that had some level of, gee, we've integrated a behavioral health consultant into primary care, or, gosh, we have a behavioral health home and we're starting to invite primary care providers in. We had, I think it was three or four. There are now 14 in Central Oregon. I think our projection was, gee, we think we'll hit 8 or 9 by the end of the transformation plan round one. One of the nice, I guess, little stories within this has been school-based health centers. And so the FQHCs, the dental organizations, the hospital system, St. Charles and Central Oregon, have come together in a really neat way and said, what do we think about school-based health? How do we view that as a productive access point? Let's have that conversation about what happens when we're taking care of a patient there who's actually assigned to some other group over here. How do we make sure we're communicating? What are we asking the payer to do from a payment perspective? You know, we could take the argument, well, gee, we're already paying for that over here because we're capitating that primary care provider. But if they're not going there, then it isn't doing much good. So we've had a really nice dialogue about school-based health centers in the community with those providers and others, the counties as well, lifting up a number of school-based health centers, all of which have some level of integration. So it isn't just a physical health nurse practitioner at the elementary school on the east side of Bend. It's physical health, behavioral health, and in I think three or not four of them, and certainly all the new ones, oral health, doing preventive screenings, looking at those opportunities to make sure we're performing on those dental quality measures, et cetera. So that's been a nice little sub-story on the integration theme in Central Oregon. There is one bidirectional site in Central Oregon. I guess that's sort of a generalization. So what is that? There's the county runs a behavioral health home for severe persistent mentally ill population. I think 300 or so residents of Central Oregon receive the vast majority of their care there. The recognition was, as is been observed around the state, these folks weren't seeing their designated primary care provider. They became very comfortable in that environment and want to have their care there. So Mosaic Medical, our local FQHC, or one of them, said, well, let's start providing some physical health care there. Initially, it was 2 days a week. It's now up to 5 days a week. And so that's been a nice story within the integration. The integration has been this elusive thing from a, well, how do you know if it works perspective? So to your question, Representative Lively, it's been elusive. How do you know that an integrated primary care home is achieving superior outcomes to a non-integrated primary care home? So in both of our regions, we've decided that we didn't know how to answer that question, and we looked for help from actually Colorado has done some really good work in this area, and so some researchers from the family practice division of one of the of the University of Colorado have sort of attached themselves to Central Oregon and the Gorge, just helping us build a framework for how do you study the effectiveness of integrated primary care. And so that's another piece that we're doing. And then as has become sort of common in both of these regions, it isn't just one entity that feels like they should be solving this problem, and certainly not the CCO. It's let's get the community together. Integration can be threatening too. So when some people hear integration, if you're wearing a public health hat or a behavioral health hat, that you're thinking, oh, they're going to take some of my money and give it to primary care because that's the direction integration's going. And so in Central Oregon, about 6 months ago, we put together a multidisciplinary integration task force, not to solve all the problems, but just to say, gosh, could we develop some shared definitions, a shared community vision for where we think this integration march goes, and ultimately even a business plan so that if we're saying we want more of these types of providers in these settings, then we're also saying, What are the incremental changes to reimbursement, and how would we pay for it, so that an entity, and I'll pick on the community mental health programs because they are the one I mentioned before. They have a 2-year kind of anticipatory time frame, as opposed to having this fear of you're just going to come to me tomorrow or someday and tell me that you're taking $3 PMPM away from me and giving it to them, and nobody likes to live in that world. So this is a group that's been meeting for 6 months. We've done environmental scanning of the landscape. We're looking at the work coming out of the university around effectiveness, and we will have in the next few months, I think, this is our community roadmap for where we want this thing to go. And then again, I think some of what we think is potent about that governance model is, you know, if our board of directors, as the CCO said, go make it so, that's just one organization, and the organization is sometimes feared. Well, you hold the money. Not that we're scary, but that role comes with, a set of expectations, I think, and sometimes how people interface with that is it's just about the money. If that gets endorsed, therefore, at a health council level where the hospital systems and the primary care components and the behavioral health organizations have said, we endorse that roadmap. Now, CCO, go effectuate that in contracts. Go make that happen. And when you run into roadblocks, come back here. You get this kind of we are us cycle going of we said we wanted to do that, right? So if one of us is an outlier in enabling that, then we all have to come back to the middle and kind of face the music. So the transparency and the accountability of that model is starting to show that it has some legs, perhaps, in terms of making change. If I flip the page to the Gorge, similar themes. In the Gorge region, there has been actually for a longer period of time than Central Oregon, the Gorge community got all over this and formed an integrated care work team. The Gorge has this great environment of provider activism around integration. So providers have come together, namely the primary care groups, and you get 4 or 5 of them in a room and you have 90% of the lives represented. They have naturally, without using terms like roadmap or business plan, just started to lay out the incremental change that they want to see in the Gorge community around integration, and that's been nice. One last anecdote. What's that?
Okay. I'd like you to move to the quality thing.
Okay, perfect. I can move there now. I was going
to
anecdote.
About to say something.
You want me to do that? I'll do 30 seconds on the Gorge. The Gorge, this is really around the theme of integration because the recognition, the Gorge we think will hit some of the highest rates of the ESPERT screens, the screening and brief intervention and referral and treatment for substance abuse in the state. And they approached it from an integrated care perspective instead of just, well, how do we just get these screens done? So they took it to their integrated care work team through which the primary care clinic said, okay, these are the workflows that we need in the clinic to then be successful in this ESPERT quality measure. So another, I think, nice anecdote in integration that's impacting a quality measure in the Gorge. Let me go to the quality. You asked the question in a very negative way. You said, what are the three measures that were intransigent and why didn't you achieve them and what hope do you have for the future or something like that?
Not right? Why didn't you achieve them. What are you going to do to achieve them?
Right. So some similar themes across both of our CCO regions. Let me actually start with the Gorge region on this one. DHS custody, the ability to or the challenge of getting a child who's newly in foster care, a physical health and a behavioral health assessment over the course of a couple months. And you've probably heard the theme before. The challenge was really agencies working together that had quite simply not worked together, identifying those kids in a timely manner, setting up the workflows in the community to make sure that care did happen. Honestly, working with a state agency that really all of a sudden, wow, I have to work with 16 CCOs on this thing, and there's not a lot in it for me to change here, and that's not quite fair. But there was a lot of coordination that really hadn't had to happen before. For our opportunity here.
Giving the staff to do what they need to do, now you give them a new assignment.
That's right, yeah. So I like the way you asked the question. So what are you going to do about it? How are you going to actually succeed in it? This one was just about communication and relationships and workflow. It was about how do you set up the things that actually need to happen, the handoffs, the communication, the right care in the right setting. This one wasn't about we need to pay a lot more money to get these assessments done. It was about communication and workflow. And so there is confidence in both of our CCO regions that those systems are now flowing, people are oriented in the right direction, and we anticipate good things there. Those numbers are small as well, as people know. So if you miss a couple, you can miss that. You'll hear this theme, and I'll just highlight this measure for both regions. Adolescent well care, again, maybe one you've heard about already. Some lack of consensus on the evidence base that is the foundation for the measure. So some pediatric groups, some family practice groups saying this actually isn't something we do every year. We haven't historically tried to do this every year. We have to reframe how we think about this type of visit. A little bit on the financial side in terms of, wow, even the primary care capitation probably doesn't cover the historical level of these visits that we've done. So we've started to have that conversation as a going forward opportunity. And then the theme that you've probably heard, which is how do you get kids in for it? How do you get parents to care about it? How do you get kids in for it? So we have taken some of the quality money that was awarded out of the quality incentive measures and in the community used some of that to try to test what incentives work to get kids in, to get parents in. So incentivizing at a patient level. The technology plan in both regions was a challenge, not to the extent that it was we were not successful on most of the facets of it. There is and this is one that I was probably a little less familiar with. I'm paraphrasing from some folks who informed me last week around this one. This really had to do with the depression screening component of that. and the recognition that historically hadn't been part of the meaningful use portfolio of things that those EHRs need to be commonly reporting out on. So that was a challenge. The Columbia Gorge, as I mentioned, had done a great job this year on ESPERT. Central Oregon We missed ESPRT by, I think it was 8 patients. So we got going a little late. The fact that expansion really impacted the denominator made a big difference. The denominator on ESPRT is all visits. And so anybody who comes in for a visit is in the denominator on ESPRT. And that's not excusing it away. It just made that achievement of it without those underlying workflows being concretely in place a challenge. So what are we doing about that one? We try to pay for performance, and it still didn't quite get us there. So we will pay X dollars per documented ESPRT, and it's sort of the classic, well, did you ask the question right? Did we actually really ask the question to some of the bigger clinics? What's it going to take from a clinical workflow perspective, an EHR perspective, a staffing perspective? If you think that this is really a measure that promotes effective care, what's it going to take to get it done? And so that's finally the conversation we're having around that one. That one you can't beat your head against the wall and just try harder. It's a system thing. It's a workflow thing. When you talk to, I've talked to a lot of providers about this because this is one of those we honestly had to have a conversation about. Do you say maybe that's a measure that we just, that's one of the 3 or 4 we may not hit, and we're just not going to put our efforts there? Do you actually admit that? And there were some providers who a year ago would have said that. They're actually coming around now that they've had some track record doing this and saying, wow, it does have an impact on patient care, especially for not those chronic severe abusers, but people on the border, that asking the question and having the conversation and that brief intervention is meaningful. So there, we have some converts that we didn't have a couple years ago on that one.
Okay. Any questions? Hey. Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Would you comment just a little bit further on the incentives at the patient level, give an example of that, how that process works?
Right. It's in particular to the quality measure that I talked about. So what we actually in our model as well, the model is interesting because when you're in the room having sort of the transparent conversation, you get poked in ways that you didn't used to get poked. So the quality money, the dollars obviously are withheld, right, at the state level, and then they're paid based on all of our CCO's performance. And so a year ago, both health councils said, well, so you're going to get that check if we all hit the quality measures, right? And we said, yeah, we're going to get the check, but we really need the money because it was removed from the global budget when they built the raise. And where we ended up was we agreed, let's take half of that money, if not even 60% in the gorge, and put it in the middle. So we did that, and there are groups of people who come together in the community that then say, okay, how are we going to hit adolescent well care? And if anybody has a good idea, come forward with it, and maybe we will fund really good ideas that lift up, you know, new quality infrastructure or insights on how to hit a measure. So that conversation was had around that measure, and 6 or 7 clinics came forward and said, I have an idea about how to get high schoolers in. It's iTunes cards. And another clinic said, I have an idea about how to get, you know, kids in from a pediatric practice, or, you know, those kinds of things. They were mostly things that were this sort of immediate reward, you know, a food gift card, an iTunes gift card to actually get kids and their parents engaged in a conversation around, let's just go get this visit done. So we don't know yet if it worked. The part of the idea was, let's spend a little bit of money to test what we think works, because this is going to have to be a push-pull. Provider outreach alone wasn't getting it done.
Follow up. You mentioned very early on in your presentation where you have the 2% profit level, and then you send this out to the health councils. Question on profit there. Is the money that goes to the health councils for new modalities, like you mentioned housing or something like that, is that considered on your financials as an expense, or is that part of a profit that's being spent somewhere else? How do you balance that accounting?
Yeah, it is. Boy, I wish I had my CFO with me here. It's after the profit and loss has been reconciled for the year, so it's dollars that otherwise would have gone into health plan reserve or become part of your capital, part of your risk-based capital. The recognition, I think, for us is that as a company who it has business in other regulated lines of business, Medicare, commercial, that in Medicaid we were okay in relation to those required capital levels. So it's dollars that otherwise would have been part of that risk-based capital equation.
So if you didn't have that relationship, it would increase your percentage of profit or it remains the same?
It would increase your net income. It would increase your bottom line. Yeah. Okay. Sure. Thank you.
Representative Lively, brief one.
Thank you. I'm just trying to understand the timing here. So at which point did you become fully operational versus all the organization to where you started? Then from that point forward, you had initiatives that you're judging, are they going to be successful or not, and what's the length of time, any of those, that you're going to judge before they are?
Right. They're different initiatives. So when we became operational as a CCO, a lot of the community partners came together and said, well, how are we going to start doing new things? Where's the dollars to do new things? And so we actually did lift up. We did some collective just funding from the various organizations, hospitals, providers, us, and started some initiatives. Those are initiatives that have been going on for 18 months or more. And then the transformation funded initiatives, the legislatively funded initiatives, are just now starting to come into a little bit of focus as to their effectiveness. And we will be asking that question, gee, which of these should become part of your CCO business model? Which of these should we seek community or grant dollars for? And which of these were just one-time things? I think I would probably just repeat or underscore it. It's I think one of the collective learnings is these things take at least a couple of years to really figure out whether something is effective. Yeah.
I'm going to take the last question. I'm sure you heard Governor Kitzhaber talk about the mythical story of the air conditioning. How do you go about buying an air conditioner?
Well, the nights are 35 degrees in our regions, and so air conditioners aren't needed. No, I don't know if there's one easy answer. I mean, flexible services is certainly one way to do that. And the state, to their credit, is really pushing us on, we know that finances are always tight in a CCO environment. Are there not things that you should be paying for, even if they aren't traditional health care payments? I think we're going to start.
Question.
What's that?
That's the question.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with it. Yeah. Bueller, you want a quick one?
Sure. Dan, what's the main barriers to integrating behavioral and physical health that you're running into?
I think that I'm not every day in a care setting, and so I'll talk from the perspective of what I hear providers talk about, new definitions of team, providers being willing to get used to working alongside caregivers that they quite simply haven't worked alongside. Certainly the question of, well, if somebody else is going to help us fund it, are they our employee or their employee? Whose employee are they? And therefore, back to that definition of team and how you work together. And then I think that there really is just this question of, well, can you put your finger on the kind of differences that it's making beyond the anecdotal? But boy, I think if you had asked that question a couple of years ago, the list of barriers would have been a lot longer than it is today. I think there are a lot of providers in both of our regions that would say, if you took that resource away from me now, not just me, because we're not the only ones trying to help fund it or enable it, mm-hmm. but if you took this away from me now, I wouldn't know how to practice good medicine. So those barriers are breaking down quickly. It's almost, when we got this integration task force together in Central Oregon the last 6 months, it's, you look at a care setting and the question anymore is almost, why not? Why aren't we integrated there?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Stevens, I want to thank you very much for coming over the mountain.
Thank you very much. It was an honor to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. Would you call the next witness, please?
Primary care of Josephine County, Roy Lean Dahlke. or is it Dalton Cossard? CEO.
We're a big entourage there.
I need to go get my eyes. Sorry.
I thought you were leaving already.
I know.
Hello, my name is Raylene Dockey, CEO of Primary Health of Josephine County. Thank you very much for this opportunity, and thank you, Chairman Greenwick, for the opportunity to come and share about the processes of primary health. We are the smallest CCO in the state of Oregon. That's our claim to fame. We went from 6,000 members to just over 12,000 members. Even with our low enrollment, we have been successful and profitable. Profitable in regards that after paying our providers fairly, investing in our community and in a number of projects, and having adequate reserves at the end of the year with surplus. Primary health rates is one of the highest in the state for meeting the quality metrics. Just this year, as far as we know, we have met all but one. Last year we had three that we did not meet, and this year it's looking like there's just going to be one that we will not be able to meet. We also have 99.5% of all of our primary health members are assigned to a Tier 3 certified PCPCH. Primary health, I've included several documents. I'll just try to briefly go over some of the highlights of what we have given to you guys. Primary Health of Josephine County is a coordinated care organization which was certified by the Oregon Health Authority in September 2012. Primary Health was originally founded in 1992 as Oregon Health Management Services, known as OHMS, a physician care organization, PCO. In 1995, we became a fully capitated health plan. Primary Health and its shareholders are committed to serving low-income and vulnerable individuals in our community. Primary Health serves the residents of rural Josephine County. The Primary Health Service area extends into the contiguous zip codes, which cover the outskirts of Jackson and Douglas County. Primary Health offers Medicaid and Medicare services. Atrio Health Plans is our partner for the Medicare product. Oregon Health Management Services, the current owner of Primary Health, also owns and operates Choices Counseling Center, founded in 1995, to provide chemical dependency services to health plan members and other residents in our community. Primary Health is ultimately governed by a board of directors. The board has three subcommittees that inform the board of the work of the CCO. These are the Quality and Compliance Committee, Clinical Advisory Panel, and Community Advisory Council. Each of these is comprised of a multidisciplinary group of stakeholders and community partners that represent the overall community of care providers. Communication between the Primary Health Board and the governance committees is accomplished through placement of board representatives of each of the board subcommittees. Quarterly reports are made to the Primary Health Board as to the status of the CCO work. Primary Health's mission guides the work of the CCO at all levels. Our guiding values are respect, enthusiasm, excellence, and creativity. At all levels, our CCO governance demonstrates a diverse representation of our delegates and community partners. The organizational culture is built through a focused effort towards relationships between each partner. We are committed to a culture of respect for members, providers, community partners, and our staff. We demonstrate this at every opportunity and every interaction. Our partnerships are built upon a foundation of trust and mutual regard. Ideas, creativity are welcome from staff, providers, and members in the spirit that innovations are born from creative minds. Finally, our culture values enthusiasm and excellence. We approach our mission with passion. We take pride that all we do is done to the best of our ability. Because of the quality of our work and the services we provide are a reflection of our commitment to Primary Health's mission. Josephine County is located in southwestern Western Oregon. Josephine County is designated as a rural community by the Oregon Office of Rural Health. The total population in Josephine County as in 2012 was just over 82,000, of which approximately 30,000 are assigned to the two CCOs that are currently in Josephine County. In 2014, largely due to the ACA expansion, primary health had a significant increase in the number of enrolled members, which increased rapidly from 6,000 to 12,000. Three major organizations serve the primary care needs of primary health members. The first is the Grants Pass Clinic, provides 52% of primary care to our members.
Wow.
Grants Pass Clinic is a large multi-specialty clinic located in Grants Pass. Siskiyou Community Health Center, the local FQHC, serves 28% of our members. And Asante Physician Partners Primary Health also contracts with independent clinics. So primarily we have three main clinics that house most of our primary care members. Many of the current primary health providers are certified under the Patient-Centered Primary Care Home Initiative. In December 2014, 99.5% of all of our members were assigned to a Tier 3 certified PCPCH. Primary health is contracted with a wide variety of specialists in Jackson and Josephine counties. Hospital services are primarily provided by the only hospital in Josephine County, Asante Three Rivers Medical Center, which is part of the Asante system. Asante has representation on primary health board, clinical advisory panel, and quality and compliance committee. The local community mental health program is Options for Southern Oregon. Options provides the majority of the outpatient, residential, and crisis mental health services in the county. Under the CCO's global budget, primary health receives funds for mental health services. Primary health has delegated the mental health operations and delivery system to Options for Southern Oregon, who has become a risk-bearing subcontractor of the CCO. Options has representation on Primary Health Board, Quality and Compliance Committee, and the Clinical Advisory Panel. As stated earlier, OMS is the founder and owner of Choices Counseling Center. Choices coordinates and provides A&D services for the CCO in close coordination with Primary Health. Choices Counseling Center is responsible for the local operations in our drug court program. To date, the local drug court program has 327 graduates. There have been 28 drug-free babies born to the participants in the drug court system. Dental care is provided by the dental care organizations in our service area. Dental care came under Primary Health's global budget in October 2013. Primary Health has contracts with all four DCOs in our service area, which are Capital Dental, Advantage Dental, Willamette Dental, and OTS. All four DCOs are risk-bearing subcontractors of the CCO. While there was no DCO representation on our board, DCOs have been offered the opportunity to participate in the CCO governance on the Clinical Advisory Panel or the Quality Committee. There are many small, large-scale pilot projects under our CCO. Themes from these projects include the following elements: a focus on the overall health of the population, not just those who are showing up in the clinic, a shift from providing services within each entity's four walls to providing services collaboratively in places where our members feel comfortable receiving them, utilizing data and outcomes to determine where and how to provide support and evaluate the effectiveness of the CCOs, expansion and refinement of the medical home model, a deep understanding that the social determinants of health play a huge role in the overall stability and wellness of our members, and that we will not succeed at shifting health outcomes until we can better address these issues. Development of a system where the resources of the host system can be opened through opening a single door. Primary Health CCO and its mental health risk-bearing partner, Options for Southern Oregon, provide leadership to the Early Learning Hub through the Hub's Executive Council and subcommittees. In 2014, 100% of children assigned to Primary Health was assigned to a Tier 3 patient-centered primary care home. Primary Health has been a supporter of both programmatically and financially with the development of the first Tier 3 patient-centered home in the state that embedded within a mental health clinic. This PCPCH, located at Options, provides wraparound service between the physical and mental health treatment to a population who struggles with compliance and medical treatment, or who may just feel more comfortable receiving physical health services within their mental health clinic. Options frequently accesses Primary Health CCO's exceptional needs coordinators. These ENCCs assist the member in barrier busting in a number of areas, including engagement with a primary care physician or reassignment to the PCPCH embedded in the mental health clinic. The community health workers work with a team of health professionals to provide patients with opportunities to stabilize and improve their health, and serves as a bridge between the community and the system of health and social services. This position serves individuals with complex medical, mental health, and or chemical dependency needs. Patients are seen in their homes or similar environments. Early data indicates that the CHW program may be effective in lowering costs. The most recent measurement in April 2015 indicates a cost reduction of 20% from the pre-engagement baseline for super utilizers. Chemical dependency services are provided and or coordinated by Choices Counseling Center, a department of OMS. Choices has co-located alcohol and drug counselors into the two largest primary care clinics in the primary health network. This has allowed an easier access point to A&D services, and providers report that they feel that individuals have accepted help that they didn't think would engage in a traditional service model. I do have a short story of one of the success stories of having one of our embedded A&D counselors there at the clinic. This is by a provider who's working at the Grants Pass Clinic. The following is a story collected from a provider at a clinic where A&D services are co-located. I have a patient in his 20s with at least two prior alcohol abuse related hospitalizations who had always refused referral for A&D treatment. He presented to the clinic with alcoholic hepatitis, jaundice with a distended abdomen. A significant percentage of these patients do not survive, but this one luckily improved in the hospital with supportive care. He returned to the clinic and again declined to be referred for treatment. None of us involved felt the patient was likely to engage. In fact, we were worried it was likely he would relapse and not survive the next hospitalization. However, the patient soon thereafter contacted the treatment provider, has been actively engaged, and has improved significantly. I don't think this would have happened without the warm handoff between the primary care doctor and the A&D counselor. The Community Health Assessment and Community Health Improvement Project. Primary Health CAC has collaborated with Jackson Care Connect and All Care Community Advisory Councils on the research and development of both their community health needs assessment and their community health improvement plans. Collaboration with the other CCOs, CACs, was critical in this work as our service areas overlap across the counties. Collaboration helped the CACs to identify the following three areas of priority: healthy beginnings, to engage in the efforts to improve the health of children, adolescents, and young adults from age 0 to 24. Health equity, to promote healthy lifestyles, improve health outcomes. Healthy living, to increase awareness of health equity and address social determinants of health. CAC members partnered in the Kids Care Fair and distributed over 700 books to the kids in the community. We also have supported a primary health pilot at maternal medical home and design implementation of the first women's medical home in Josephine County. The goals of the MMH was to improve birth outcomes through systematic enhancements in the delivery system. OHA incentive measures baseline data in 2011 indicated that only 65% of mothers had timely access to prenatal care. Within the first trimester, or 42 days of enrollment in Medicaid. In 2014, Primary Health improved this rate to 83%. Primary Health DME program distributes medical equipment like diabetic supplies and nebulizers directly from our office. This program has also increased our ability to engage and provide case management with members. Through this process, Primary Health is also able to better monitor appropriate utilization of supplies and encourage preventive care and healthy behaviors. Primary Health and Choices have been a supportive and intricate part of the development of a facility in Grants Pass to serve intoxicated individuals. This facility will reduce the use of inappropriate and inexpensive expensive resources such as hospital and jail beds. This program is slated to open in January 2016. Josephine County hasn't had a sobering unit for many, many years, and it's really been difficult when we have so many homeless people, and there's nowhere for them to go. And the hospital and jail beds just wasn't the appropriate place. They'd go there and be released, and nothing ever got better for these people. Primary Health found several opportunities to collaborate with the OMS Community Health Education Center, which is a nonprofit that OMS has and operates. In 2014. OMS assisted in curriculum development for several health and wellness-focused classes in 2014. The most popular offered at OMS is a free healthy cooking class offered to anyone in the community. OMS Check and Primary Health recognize the connection between obesity, chronic disease, and poor diet. In addition, it was recognized that many people in the community do not know basic food preparation.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up quickly.
Okay.
Could you go to the quality measures?
Yes, I will.
That, and then we'll have about 10 minutes for questions.
Primary Health has made improvements on all 17 of the quality pool measures. The three most difficult measures in 2014 was for the CCO was ESPERC, colorectal cancer screening, and adolescent well care. All three of these targets were not met in 2013, but two of the three have been met in 2014. The strategies to improve on these measures were multifaceted. They included elements such as sharing dashboards with providers and clinics, creating provider or clinic level gap lists, utilizing analytics to find both care gaps and areas of high performance, sharing data regularly and creating channels of communication, facilitating training such as expert screening for providers throughout the network, investing time, energy, and resources in strategies that will be sustainable over time and create changes to the infrastructure of our delivery of care. And just in conclusion, I'll say real quick that this process that we've gone through for the quality metrics has been exciting because we have the buy-in from the from the managers at the clinics and to the providers. And we have heard many, many times that nothing has the way we deliver care, the relationships that we have built have fundamentally changed in Josephine County. And the words of one stakeholder capture it best. It says, no matter what happens, we will never go back to delivering care the way it was, no matter what. And this has been exciting to hear the providers talk this way. They've seen the successes. They've seen lives change. And they buy it. And it's exciting because it's a great group to work with. And it's an easy sell.
Sounds great. Some questions?
Representative Stark has a question.
He's not used to seeing me. Yeah.
I didn't see you down there at all. Welcome, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, by the way, thank you for mentioning the sobering facility, Senate Bill, or House Bill 2936. We're still waiting for it to make its way the rest of the way through the building. But on the, with mental health, you know, you guys have kind of a unique partnership with Options, as you mentioned. Would you kind of comment on, compared to some of the other models the CCOs have done with mental health, how has that been working for you guys, that partnership, what's unique about it, and just kind of overall thoughts?
It's probably been one of the most exciting things that has happened. I really thought that it would take longer for the integration of mental health in with our medical group. I had no idea that we'd be as far along as we are right now. When we work with Options for Southern Oregon, it's like working with another department in our business. It's not us and them. So when we sit down at the table and we discuss options for what we should do, the trust and the relationship we have, we're all working for the good of the community, and it's worked unbelievably. We have embedded in three clinics, well, more than that right now, mental health and drug and alcohol, and it's just working wonderfully with the doctors. 3 years ago, Options for Southern Oregon offered their services into the clinics, and they weren't interested. They could not see past their current workflow. They didn't want to change it. And now they would not have that in their clinic. So it's been wonderful.
Great. Great deal. Mr. Stark.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I'm just making a comment because I've been trying to, all these CCOs are different, you know, as we've been learning through all this.
It's interesting to have one that's got such a small population in a small area, because I think you get a really good feel for what's actually happening on the ground. I assume in the larger ones there's a lot of this sort of thing that's happening, but you get a better sense of like what it's actually trying to accomplish when you hear about, you know, one that's just completely county-based in a small county. I feel like I'm finally understanding it.
I have a comment. To be in the smallest CCO, I think that we are greatly advantaged by being the smallest CCO. We're able to get our arms around our members. We know our members. And our partnerships are primarily in Josephine County. And I think that we are greatly advantaged by being small, community-based.
How do you reimburse? Do you subcapitate any of the systems?
We do. We subcapitate almost all of our primary care providers. We subcapitate several of our different services, like lab. We've done that for many years. But what we have changed since the CCO is that the Metrics Quality Fund goes back to the providers who earn it. So if you're a higher performing clinic, you'll get more of that money. And it's very clear, and we show all the providers, and we show where they are, we show their gaps, and we work with them intensely. Jennifer Johnson's our QI director, and puts a lot of efforts, and that's why our numbers are getting much better. Not so much, I think, because of their payment, but because it's so visual and transparent to how they're doing, how well they're doing.
How about the hospital?
The hospital is working very well with us. We don't subcap them. Wynn Howard, their CEO in Josephine County, is on our board and works very well with us and supporting the different projects that we have. But right now it's still fee-for-service, DRG-based.
And I don't know whether you heard me ask the question before about the refrigerator, but the air conditioner. Might be refrigerator. The air conditioner. Cool. How do you deal with things that you don't have a code to bill for, but a physician thinks that the patient really needs?
Well, currently there are no codes for the majority of the flexible services that we have. And so whenever we spend money on the flexible services, it goes under our admin, because there's no way of putting it in the medical budget.
And you do have a way to spend money on flexible services?
We do. Jen, would you like to speak to that?
Hi, my name is Jennifer Johnston, and I am the quality director at Primary Health. And thanks for asking this question. We have a process by which a provider or a staff member, a community health worker, even a member themselves can request a flexible service, and we capture that on a form that is a little bit more information than our traditional request. And it talks about why they think the flexible service would be beneficial, what other treatments have been considered, and so all of that information comes together, and how much they think it will cost. And so we have a process by which the decision making happens, and it really has to do with the dollar, the specific dollar amount of what's been requested. But there is definitely a real clear pathway for the way flexible services are reviewed and approved on our facility, and it makes it simple for anyone to request them.
Excellent. Senator Hayden.
Chair Greenlee, thank you. On your access to healthcare providers for your clientele, how have state-based incentives helped get access and to keep providers there
for you, or can you tell an effect on that?
We're unique in Josephine County in that we really don't have access issues. We were able to, when we went from 6,000 members to 12,000, we were able to assign every one of our members within a 24-hour period with a PCPCH. The commitment from our providers in Josephine County is just there. And even doctors who were close to new members, when we'd go to them and say, we need more, they would open up. We had some internal medicine doctors that currently in 2012 was maybe their panel was only maybe 70, and they're well over 400 now. That's the kind of commitment that we have in Josephine County with the doctors.
Did you say 70,000 out of 82,000?
70. They went from 70, only 70.
No, I'm talking about your whole population.
We went from 6,000 to 12,000.
But I thought I heard you say that the CCO population included 70,000 of the 82,000 people.
Of the 82,000 total population in Josephine County, 30,000 are assigned to a CCO. So about 37% of our total population is assigned to a CCO.
Well, thank you.
Sorry. Follow up?
One quick one. So there's a difference between assignment and access. When a patient gets assigned to a clinic versus how long it takes them to get in.
We definitely monitor the time when they make an appointment until they get in.
I
can tell you that it has it's better today than it was 2 years ago. All three clinics have an urgent care, which helps. So if they have an urgent need, we can get them in immediately. And what would you say the wait time is?
The wait time varies between the different clinics, but I would say some clinics, I mean, all are within the state's standards for compliance and getting folks in. And I would think for urgent appointments, people are getting in the same day or the next day.
Didn't get to finish my question there, but for a scheduled primary care appointment with an OBGYN, how long does that take for somebody that is establishing that from their primary care physician?
I'm not sure about OBGYN, but for primary care, I would say within 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. May I?
Sure.
So one of the parts of the maternal medical home pilot really focused on access and getting women in early in pregnancy. And so that's a priority that they have communicated even out to their schedulers, that if they have a woman that's perhaps canceled a visit and she's nearing that 12-week point, that they will do anything in their power to get her in, period, before that 12-week date, because they feel like getting early access is important. So I think, you know, they do have some ability to triage, but access is very important, but a really important part of the maternal medical home pilot.
And apply that question to dental very quickly.
I think we really need to wrap up. We have one more panel and we're running out of time.
Okay.
Thank you so much for coming up from Josephine County. We really appreciate it. Really exciting for us to hear from the baby.
We're having a lot of fun. I mean, we really are enjoying this process.
That's great. Thank you.
Wow.
Mr. Chair.
Great.
Yes.
May I make a 30 seconds or less comment?
3 seconds.
All right. Because where Lean is from home for me, and on the access issue, all 5 of my children have had primary health, and we've been able to get in same day when we want future appointments. We get in. My wife's been able to get in within a week for OBG appointments. Wow. They've been absolutely phenomenal as far as access.
That's great. Excellent.
We do real care there.
Yay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Did you call the next panel, please? In the next room.
Our last presentation is from Trillium Community Health. Terry Copeland, CEO, is presenting today.
We're down to T alphabetically, huh?
Yes, we are.
Is that how we're doing it?
It's all about alphabet.
Very systematic of you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Try locked.
My first name, too.
How many?
My first name, too.
And go for it.
Yeah.
Chairman, Chair Greenlake, committee members, my name is Terry Copeland. I'm the CEO of Trillium Community Health Plan. Dr. Korjenik, our COO, is here with me in case there are unlikely questions that I'm able to answer. So I'm very pleased to be here. Shall I just begin,
please,
Mr. Chair? So this is, you know, I've been since my adult entire adult life, I have worked in the healthcare sector, either on the provider side or the insurance side. I've never seen a time more interesting and exciting than this. I've never seen more change in such a short period of time than we've seen the last couple of years. So Trillium was formed in 2006, actually, as an insurance company to manage a Medicare product, primarily around the dual eligibles with the Trillium Community Health Plan for the dual eligibles and LIPA at that time for the OHP members. Since then, we had been working with the county for a number of years, and in 2012, we had applied to become a CCO, and Lane Care with the county government had managed the Medicare or the mental health portion of the Oregon Health Plan in Lane County. We merged those two together, both from LIPA and Lane Care under Trillium, to have them under one entity with an attempt not to create new entities or new administrative structures. So since then, we started out with about, at the end of 2012, I think we had about 37,000 lives under our plan at that time. By the end of 2015, or by today in 2015, we've got approximately 95,000 OHP members. And if you put all of our members together, we've got just over 100,000 lives that's in our plan. It's under Trillium. So the parent company, by the way, is Agate Resources. I think you guys probably may have heard that already, but Agate Resources is a shareholder-owned company primarily by physicians in Lane County, and it's a for-profit company and has been since its inception.
That's not your new company coming out there.
I beg your pardon?
That's not the company, the new company?
No. No. Mr. Chair, I think you may be referring to Centene, which is a company. Yes. Yes. Agate Resources is the holding company for Trillium Community Health Plan and has been. So.
But Centene has purchased Agate? Is that?
Yes. Centene is proposing to purchase Agate Resources. Yes.
You might comment on that later, but.
I'd be glad to.
But please go on.
Okay. You know, we've got a couple of slides in your packet about the size of the county. I do want to talk a little bit about the member demographics, however. Of that 95,000, we have about 61,000 who are adults and 34,000 who are children in our plan. I would also comment that up just over 40% of the births in Lane County are from OHP, OHP members. I will also say that of our membership, 37% of the women who are pregnant in OHP smoke. And so you'll hear that theme.
Say that again. How many smoke?
I beg your pardon?
I didn't catch what you said about smoking. How many?
37% of the pregnant women in our population smoke.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a huge public health issue for us, and it's one we put a lot of money in so far. When you talk about flexible funds, that's part of what we spend those monies on. Our Trillium Board of Directors, we have 22 members on the board. They represent providers, behavioral health, dental, hospitals, consumers, public health. Our board minutes, our approved board minutes are public. They're on our website for everyone to review. We have... Right now, we're having two public meetings a year. We have had as many. The first year, we had four public meetings. The year after that, three. But our standard is to have at least two public meetings where we talk about the CCO. We call them our community conversations, where we invite people to ask us questions, make comments, and give advice, which people often do. Our community and rural advisory councils, we have two, and likely we'll have three community advisory councils shortly. We have the community advisory council within the Eugene Springfield area. And in addition to that, in our outlying areas, we have a rural community advisory council because we're beginning to integrate Reedsport and Douglas County also in that lower Umpqua area into our CCO. We may have a third, but we're working with the community to see how they want that structured. Our CAC currently has three primary work groups on prevention, member engagement, and health disparities. So in terms of revenues, risk, and profitability, as I mentioned, just over the last 2 years, we've added almost 40,000 members to our plan. So since the beginning, since the inception of the CCO, we've increased gross revenues by about three times. But it's all related to that increase in population. Reserves for our company are defined, and requirements are from the insurance division. And the insurance division monitors, controls, and tells us how much we need to put into reserves, and for the safety of the public. And currently, by the end of 2015, I believe we will need to have about $32 million in reserves. That's the risk-based capital reserves required by the insurance division, which we will be there. And by the way, we're a for-profit company, as mentioned, and so 40% of our profits go to taxes. Administrative costs are about 8%. Key partners in Lane County, I think if you look down the bullet points on our key partners, you'll see that's reflected very well in the board members on Trillium Community Health Plan. So that's very simpatico with these particular partners. The CHIP is the Lane County Community Health Improvement Plan, which we participate in with the county, with United Way, with Peace Help, and others, including the Early Learning Hub, now as part of that CHIP development. And you can see the five areas that for our community on our community health improvement plan that we'll be focusing on: advance improve health equity, prevention and reduction of tobacco use, slow the increase in obesity, prevent and reduce substance abuse, mental illness, and improve access to health care. And in speaking about access to health care, as I mentioned, we over the last 2 years, we've added about 40,000 members. We completely saturated primary care in our community. It was almost all primary care physicians in our community accept OHP patients right now. It's just that we have run out of primary care providers. So over the last 2 years, we have been working on several projects and investing a lot of money in trying to increase capacity. And by doing that, we've offered incentives for provider groups who accept new members. Last year, we gave $900,000 to the county to start a new community health center, in which the county started that project from zero in February of 2014. In August of 2014, they began accepting members. They opened the doors, began accepting members, and we've added another 5,000 members in capacity as a result of that. This year, we're also making a grant to the county to start yet another one, and we're making a $1 million grant to the county, and we anticipate that when they open that clinic, they'll be able to take somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 members. We've got other types of grants that we're making to other similar grants to primary care groups, and we believe that by the end of this year, we currently have about 12,000 to 13,000 lives that are not assigned to primary care yet of that 95,000. But we think by the end of the year, we will be able to create another 20,000 to 21,000
capacity lives in addition to what we have now with our current projects. We've also hired a national consultant to work with primary care groups to increase their efficiency. We've made transformation grants to increase capacity in clinics as well. As I said earlier, we're using flexible funds for tobacco prevention and other programs. We're putting $1.33 per member per month into prevention projects. And as I'm not sure that my math will work here, but at 95,000 members, that comes out to about, what, $125,000 a month that we're putting into prevention.
A year and a half, roughly.
Yeah. including the good behavior game, for example, that we've trained 200 classroom teachers in 14 of our 15 districts to use the good behavior game. The Q-tip program, which is an incentive program for pregnant women to provide through the WIC program, tobacco cessation counselors. We've trained 50 to be certified tobacco cessation counselors. I'll just go in quickly. We have an obesity program as well that I've described here and in your documents. Our mental health promotion program that we've have instituted. we're doing a lot of work with the integration of physical and behavioral health. And actually, we started this in terms of working with the county before the CCO, so I believe we got a jump on that and have made a lot of progress with that. The TILP programs that we have is called the Trillium Integration Incubator Projects. We have made grants to different clinics to who have different methodologies for or different ways of integrating behavioral health and physical health. For example, from a real high level, we have four programs where we're integrating behavioral health into physical health, and we have four programs where we're integrating physical health into behavioral health. And these have been really exciting projects to watch develop and unfold. We've set up a relationship with the Oregon Research Institute to help us track the results of those over time so that we can see what the impact of those really are. We funded Trillium University, which what we call Trillium University, where we hold different programs throughout the year, educational programs for providers. Some of the examples is that we've had a behavioral health program for expert depression screening. We've presented programs on tools for successful integration. We've done programs on health literacy, on integration strategies for primary care medical homes. In terms of quality measures, the adolescent well care quality measure, we did not reach that quality measure.
Nor did anybody else.
Well, there was a lot of new members. We had 2,300 new adolescent members who qualified, and our the denominator. Help me out with this.
The denominator was, introduce myself. I'm Patrice Korchenik. I'm the Chief Operations Officer at Trillium. In 2013, the denominator was a little over 9,000, and in 2014, the denominator was 11,000.
So getting those folks in, getting those young folks in has been a challenge. But I think we're making progress with this. We've had some special programs to get them in, some incentives. We've had the adolescent well care super Saturdays where pediatric clinics have opened their doors to bring in these kids. And as you can see, in combination with member incentives, over 300 adolescents received their annual exams in quarter four. It's not good enough, but we're making progress on that. Quality measure two, patient-centered primary care medical home enrollment. The issue, we made that, but we just barely, and the reason we just barely made that was because many of our members were assigned to new clinics that we had funded and helped to start. And those new clinics the first year cannot be a primary care medical, certified primary care medical home. So we were assigning members to clinics who may have qualified, but were not eligible for the first year. We will continue to do that next year, even though it hurts our metrics, but we've got to get access to care for those folks. Quality measure 3, ED utilization. Again, we had, over the last 2 years, over 40,000 new members to come into the plan. We're working with the hospital EDI pre-managed program, and we have some other strategies going on as well. So that's an overview. I hope I'm sorry I spoke so quickly, but I wanted to make sure we had time for
Great.
Questions.
Thank you. Well, yes, Representative,
I have a question if we have time.
We do. We have.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee.
10 minutes before we get thrown out.
Appreciate the presentation and working through the quality matrix. One thing that seems to be a sustainability possible option with transformation dollars is to work on, and I think your geographically your area with your healthcare facilities that you have available would be a good target for primary care residencies. Has there been any discussion about using transformation dollars, or do we need to look to the state for some funding of that or some additional match grant funding from the federal government? My understanding is we have about 28 primary care residency slots in the state, and I think we need to move that to 50.
Representative Hayden, that is a key long-term strategy that we have. These investments in clinics are a short-term strategy. The long-term strategy is working both with our federal delegation and with our local delegations here to be able to create a residency program in our region. We have had a number of meetings around this topic. We currently are part of the a program to set up training programs for both nurse practitioners and PAs. So we're starting there to get some primary care additions. But our long-term goal, and we're working really hard with this, is to get funding to help start a residency program for primary care physicians as well. It's a key strategy.
Yeah, for sustainability and long-term, I'd love to see that as part of, you know, part of the process.
Yeah, I agree. It would take from start to finish about 3 years to first get a resident into the program. So that's why I say it's a long-term goal.
Yeah, but 2012 wasn't that long ago. So
it really wasn't.
I'd like to go back to the question I asked you before.
Yes.
You were built out of, well, you're a profit-making organization. You were built out of local, like LIPA, out of local stock. All of a sudden, this would be the first time a CCO was taken over by a pretty large national corporation. Does that make you guys nervous? Is there a way to safeguard the essence of what the CCO movement is under those circumstances? How do you see that happening?
Yeah, Representative Greenlee, committee members, that's a reasonable question. We've done a lot of diligence on this, but also recall that the Trillium Board of Directors and the CAC and the clinical advisory panels are the ones who run the health plans, and much of that is hardwired into legislation. The construction of the board of directors of Trillium is defined already in rule and legislation. That will not change. Our management will not change. The Centene will be buying Agate Resources, the parent company of Trillium. The impact of that will be to, now, for us, is to give us access to resources that would take years for us to build. Resources is going to accelerate the movement toward the triple aim and doing what the CCO was intended to do. We need those resources if we're going to move in a fast, efficient way, and they will be able to provide that, and it will not it will not take away from the local control that we have now. We've been careful to structure this so.
Well, what's the relationship now between the board of the parent company and the CCO board?
The board of the parent company, Agate Resources, their job is to manage at the policy level. If in fact, to the degree that the Trillium board is doing well and is operating the company the way they're supposed to, toward the goals, there's no interaction between the Agate board and the Trillium board. If it looks like the Trillium board was going to do something that bankrupted the company, then they would then have some influence to step in. But to the degree that they're continuing to do a good job, then there's no interaction at all. There are some members on the Agate board that's also on the Trillium board, but they're providers. And they're leaders within the provider leaders within the community. So.
We've got Kenny Geyer and Bueller.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up on the chair's question about the financial arrangement. Is this the only for-profit CCO?
Representative, no.
Or ownership primarily?
No, there are, I believe there are 10 for-profit uh-huh. CCOs, but I don't take that to the bank, as they say, but I think it's something. Okay. There are other for-profits,
and
yes.
Can you explain how the profits then get distributed? Is it to the shareholders? Is it a publicly traded company?
It's
privately held?
Representative, it's currently privately held. Mm-hmm. And so we have not paid dividends in mm-hmm. maybe 8 years. Mm-hmm. But there was one or two years where we did pay dividends, but that's been eight to nine years ago. Mm-hmm. So currently, there is no distribution to shareholders, mm-hmm. and what the shareholders have benefited from this was in 1996, when they invested in the company, originally. Is that the difference between that share price then mm-hmm. and when they retire? That's when they saw the benefit of that. And but we haven't been doing dividends. So, and in fact, since 2012, after we paid taxes on our profits, then that money has been going to two places: one, into required reserves, and two, into these other programs that I described earlier, that it's really administrative expenses, and we will not see the benefit of that as part of our medical services budget.
Representative Bueller.
Yes, thank you, Chair Greenlick. Do you think the lack of access to primary care in Lane County has artificially lowered your medical loss ratio?
Representative Bueller, it did in 2014. There's no question that because we had that huge influx that came in initially, there wasn't access. By the end of the year, we had provided access for that entire population in 2014, and so we're starting to see the curve come back now on the impacting the medical loss ratio. But there's no question, particularly early in 2014, we had a lower medical loss ratio because of that.
Follow-up, sure. And the valuation for the purpose of this sale is based on 2014 valuations?
Representative Bueller, are you referring to the total valuation for the company valuation, or what are you, are the valuation on whether or not to do the sale?
The valuation of the acquisition by Centene.
Centene has looked at the performance over the last 5 years, not just over 2014. And so we've worked with them really on what our business model is, but they would definitely not make that kind of a decision based on a 1 year performance. They also, because They work with Medicaid across the country. They have a very good understanding about the utilization of new members. As new members come in, even when you have providers, adequate providers, there's still those that initial, say, six-month period of time where there's low utilization, and then it begins to trend upward, and then it comes back down to the norm. But that's a very typical pattern. They're aware of that. They know very well what happened in 2014.
All right, I'll try a last question before we're thrown out of here. The reserve that you say is required by the insurance division, is that because of your CCO operation, or is that because you're an insurance company in a broader context?
Chairman Greenlee, committee members, it's because we're an insurance company, and we are regulated under the authority of the Oregon Insurance Division rather than the Oregon Health Authority.
And that's for a population larger than your CCO population? Or is it only your CCO? You're in the exchange, too, I think, is that right?
That's for our entire population. It's for Oregon Health Plan members, Medicare, Exchange, and PELP members as well.
So the profits from the CCO going into that reserve, is that the reserve for the larger population, or the reserve just for the CCO population?
Each product contributes to that. The majority comes from the CCO, the OHP, because that's the majority of the members.
Majority of the population.
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming over.
You're welcome.
Today.
It's
we
my
very
pleasure.
Much appreciate it. We have hearings on Wednesday. Assuming we don't have an afternoon session, and the following Monday, is that right?
Friday. We have two CCOs.
We still have Friday. Okay.
Yes, two CCOs on Friday.
Okay.
So 1 hour meeting.
Is it Friday?
We are adjourned.
Good job.
Thank you all, guys.
Good job.
Thank you all, guys.